Today on a special rambling about cars, Chevrolet Colorado, Ford F-150 Raptor, they're four-wheel drive, but we're also going to talk some two-wheeled vehicles with a very special guest. Yes, it's the four-wheel drive and motorcycle episode. So without further ado, it's podcast time. I'm Christopher Smith. As always, across the way, Mr. Chris Bruce. How you doing, man? And tell us about our special, special guest. This could get dangerous. I'm just going to tell people right now, this could get really dangerous, the three of us.
I'm doing okay. Yeah, looking forward to this episode. We're going to start the show off with some truck talk, specifically the new Chevrolet Colorado, which hasn't technically debuted as we are recording the show, but it will when it comes out. And the Ford F-150 Raptor R. But our special guest this week is Jason Marker. He is the editor-in-chief over at Ride Apart, which is our network's motorcycle-focused site. If any of you like vehicles with two wheels, or in the case what he's going to be talking about, three wheels. Definitely head over there. They do fantastic work. But Jason, I will let you introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jason. I live in Detroit, and I like motorcycles.
How many motorcycles do you have right now, Jason?
Currently, I have 11.
That's it?
Let me see.
That's it?
Is that right? I have 11? I have four parts bikes. I have that live outside. I have three runners and five.
Tell our listeners.
A 1972 Honda CB500 in Flake Sunrise Orange, a 1980 Yamaha XS850 that was originally in Macho Maroon, and that was my very first bike. I've had that bike for more than 20 years.
Nice.
Wow.
And my 2022 Euro Gear Up that I just bought a month ago. And then I have three projects going right now.
And just to prime people in what we're going to talk about later, the Euro that you just bought, you already have a gazillion miles on it because you bought it across the country.
And then
spent a few weeks riding it home.
Not a few weeks. No, I bought it in Salem, Oregon, and I spent 11 days riding it back to Detroit.
That's almost 2 weeks. Like
it's almost 2 weeks. Well, it sounds better when you say a few weeks.
To be fair, I lived on that bike from June 20th to July 6th.
And part of that trip was a stop right behind me in Motor One's Rapid City, South Dakota office.
The South Dakota desk, yeah.
Where I got to meet you finally in person. And the reason, folks, I said this could be dangerous. The three of us, okay, this is actually the first time we've like vocally spoken together, but we've
Correct.
In our Microsoft Teams chat, we're just like in our own zone of awesome where we're talking cars, bikes, video games, all kinds of cool stuff. So when I say this could be dangerous, as you can see, we're already like 3 minutes and 30 seconds into the podcast and we haven't really talked about anything specific yet aside from the motorcycles. We should probably jump over to some truck talk. And
yeah, why don't you talk about your filthy car stuff, and then we'll come back to a proper conversation topic.
And before we do, just a quick reminder, follow us on YouTube, Spotify, Google, any place where there are podcasts, you can find us. Like, follow, subscribe, hit all of those buttons. It lets us do more crazy, cool stuff that we're going to do a little bit today. And it starts with the 2023 Chevrolet Colorado, the new midsize Chevy truck. And yeah, this is debuting on Thursday, July 28th. So a day after you're hearing this podcast, a day before as we're recording. And Bruce, can you tell us a little bit about it? Because you were on a backgrounder with Chevrolet getting a little bit of info. Plus you wrote up the debut article. So tell us about it.
I sure did. Sorry, I am trying to get the slideshow on this going as I am talking to you folks. So yeah, things are getting a bit complicated on my end right now, but bear with me and we will get you there. New 2023 Chevrolet Colorado, new generation for the truck. And it is a pretty significant change all the way around. So it rides on a new chassis. It's the wheelbase is 3.1 inches longer. The engineers, they made sure they pushed the front wheels further to the front. That means the front overhang is shorter. That means the approach angle is better. And that's true for all of the trucks throughout the range. And they also, they clearly see who is buying these trucks, because there are 5 trim levels. 3 of them are off-road oriented.
And for the record, Bruce, I'm trying to get a slideshow going on my end too, and it's probably because we don't have this article published yet as we're recording this.
We do not. Right.
It occurs to me that might be why. We'll get some images up for those following on YouTube here in a second. But keep telling us a little bit about it, because I mean, I'm actually learning along with everybody listening, because I haven't even had a chance to look at like the embargoed information, the background stuff. It's a really kind of, I think it's a pretty aggressive update, especially in the ZR2 form. I mean, I feel like Chevrolet is really, they've taken notice that there's a midsize Ranger back in the market, because I mean, Chevrolet, GMC, they kind of had things to themselves with the Colorado and the Canyon for several years. And now that the Ranger is back, it's kind of like, ooh, we better step up the game a little bit. And I mean, in ZR2 trim especially, it's just, it looks kind of mean.
Right. So let's go through the trim levels while we're talking about that. So you've got 5 trim levels at launch. You've got work truck, which, or WT is how they, you know, shorten it. But that is, it is what it says on the tin. It is kind of the very basic version for people who are going to use this thing for work. That's fine. There's the LT, which is kind of the bread and butter version for regular consumers. There's the Z71, which is kind of a mildly off-road version. There's the ZR2, which has even more off-road goodies, and there's Trail Boss. And in addition to that, there is the Desert Boss special edition of the ZR2. And that has
edition, all the things.
Right. Or I'm sorry, it's special edition package. There's the ZR2 Desert Boss as well, which takes the ZR2, adds even more stuff onto it to make it even better, kind of going off-road in the desert, as the name implies. Quite a few versions. What's interesting, though, is you essentially now have one engine in the Colorado, where currently you have a 4-cylinder, a V6, and a 4-cylinder turbo diesel. Across the board now, you only get a 2.7-liter turbocharged 4-cylinder, but it's available in 3 tunes. So in the work truck and the LT, that makes 237 horsepower, 259 pound-feet of torque, and it can tow 3,500 pounds. In the Z71 and Trail Boss, let me back up a second. There's also what they're calling the 2.7-liter Turbo Plus, which makes 310 horsepower, 390 pound-feet of torque, and can tow 7,700 pounds. That comes standard in the Z71 and the Trail Boss, but is an optional upgrade on the work truck and the LT. Okay. So you can get all that. And then finally, there's the Turbo High Output, which is another step up from the Plus. Same horsepower rating of 310 horsepower, but torque grows to 430 pounds.
So a little bit more torque, yeah.
Yeah. Well, good bit. What is that? 40 pound-feet of torque is a good chunk. And that is only available on the ZR2. So engine, 3 outputs.
Props to Chevrolet for trying to simplify the line. I mean, I'm sure it's going to save them some cost. Mm-hmm. It's curious. I mean, has you know, especially just recently with GM's aggressive talk about electrification, there's no mention of any sort of hybrid or anything. It's like the only thing you're going to get is a 2.7 liter turbo. And I'm assuming there are no fuel mileage estimates yet for this engine.
No pricing, no fuel economy. The other thing is now there's a single body style, which is the crew cab, and I guess what you would call the standard bed length, whereas currently on the Colorado you have 2 bed lengths, and you can also get an extended cab long bed. Now one form, at least for 2023. Then during the backgrounder, they didn't really make it sound like other versions were coming. They there's a lot of simplification if you think about it that way, that you get one body style and you've got one engine and three power levels, rather than currently, you know, you've got two cab styles, two bed lengths, and three engines. So
yeah,
there's kind of simplifying things down there. But it really seems like they invested the money where it made sense to. I'm going to throw up a picture of the interior. So all models from work truck to the top of the line, you get, let me double check, I think it's 11.3 inches is the size of the infotainment. Let me double. Yeah, 11.3 inches diagonal infotainment screen and an 8-inch diagonal digital instrument cluster. And that's, like I said, on everything. So high tech in there. Yeah, it just seems kind of cool. I'm not a truck guy. You and I've had this conversation before. I would rather have an SUV or a crossover or whatever. I just, trucks don't really fit my use case, but this seems like a pretty good truck. And Jason, I know you said you're not a new car guy, but I will let you know they did add to the bed. There are now scalloped out sections that they say can be for a motorcycle or bicycle tire to put
it
in the
still,
bed.
Is it still a 6.5-foot bed?
Ah, buddy, I don't know. I believe it is, yes.
Because any truck that's not a standard cab long bed is worthless to me.
You know, we hear that. I mean, we hear that a lot. There are a lot of people that would like to see at least some form of, I guess what you would call the more traditional truck, single cab with a longer bed, because I mean, that's sort of the purpose of the truck, is having that cargo space.
Yeah, I mean, I've hauled bikes in like second gen Rangers with the tailgate down, and I hate it.
Yeah,
I mean, not because I love Rangers, like Rangers, the ultimate truck, but I would like to have the whole bike inside the truck.
Oh, you're not alone. Yeah. Not alone. We hear that quite a bit. I'm assuming, because Bruce, you mentioned there is a lot of simplification going on here. One can only assume that Chevrolet, they've looked at the numbers, they looked at the stats, seen how their truck sells. This is probably the version that sells the best. I mean, this combination of cab and bed length.
Presumably, yeah. I mean, that's the only reason they would do that. Plus, right. You know, they can, you know, they essentially simplified things when it comes to manufacturing the truck, that there's one body style and you put one version of three engines into it. And you pump, you know, you don't have to worry about making a V6 and a four cylinder and a turbo diesel. You just make this one four cylinder. You figure out which version of the turbo and stuff you're putting into it. And then you put it in the truck and you roll it off the line. But on the other hand, you can also tell that they're Trail Boss Z71 and ZR2. They clearly have seen the writing on the wall, and that buyers definitely want a truck that at least looks rugged. And so that's what they're doing.
I tell you, I like the look of this a lot better than the Silverado, and I like the look of this much better than the outgoing Colorado. I think it's a sharp looking truck, honestly, compared to this or a Ranger. My initial reaction is to go Colorado.
Yeah, I mean, we won't know until we drive it and stuff like that. But at least in terms of, it's a nice looking truck. I do, real quick, before we move on, I want to mention kind of, you know, the range topper, or at least the range topper in terms of going off road. So the ZR2, it comes with a factory 3-inch suspension lift and Multimatic dual spool valve dampers, which is quite nice. You know, everyone kind of loves that suspension. It also has the flow tie badge, which, you know, we've seen from previous Chevy products. It has different bumpers to improve the approach and departure angle. It's got a skid plate to protect the radiator and the oil pan. Rides on 17-inch wheels with 33-inch tires. And then if you go to the ZR2's Desert Boss package, you also get 17-inch wheels that are beadlock capable, a brush bar, a style bar on the bed, a roof-mounted life bar, underbody camera, and some special decals. Hmm. So the ZR2 is kind of, if you're going off-road, the ZR2 is the one to pick.
No, I got to give Chevrolet some credit here. I think it's a pretty good looking truck. be interesting to see how people stack it up against the Ranger. And I gotta wonder if Ram is sitting over in the corner thinking, damn it. you know, they had the Dakota by themselves for so long in this segment. And it's like, I don't know. It's time. You know,
but we haven't heard anything really. Like, we've heard some like very scanty rumors, but
yep,
I don't know. But I was going to say real quick, I think it's interesting. Oh, damn it. I just lost my train of thought. Let me look at what I was just looking at. I think it's interesting that, you know, they're really taking a big swing here, in my opinion, because I'm surprised that there's not a hybrid model. I'm surprised that they're getting rid of the turbo diesel. Like, you know, the turbo diesel, especially, I bet it doesn't have a huge take rate, but also I know there are a lot of people out there that I want to be able to get a diesel pickup truck. And the hybrid, that just seems kind of like the future. I'm surprised that they're not like, you know, we'll do a 2.7 liter turbo hybrid or something like that. So it's interesting that they're kind of just sticking with that one engine.
Well, and with, you make a good point, by the way, because I was thinking that as well. Just one engine, no sort of electrification, while GM is talking about how they're going to become the world's top selling automaker for EVs. With one body style here, with one engine option, maybe they're setting us up for a Colorado EV in maybe 2 or 3 years. Right.
Yeah. They were very clear that this is the 2023 truck that, you know, as always in kind of these backgrounders and things, they do not talk about future product, but also they didn't really even hint at it. Like, people ask questions, especially about hybrid, and they didn't really even like, because sometimes, Smith, you've done these things and they'll be like, well, maybe
it can happen.
We'll see what happens. Like, they were sticking to their guns that this was the truck. So we'll see, but it doesn't seem like it's happening anytime soon unless Chevy had a really good poker face.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's, cause we've got to get to Jason. We've got to talk about, his bikes. We got to talk about the epic road trip. One quick segue into trucks before we do. And Jason, you were talking about Ranger. How do you feel about F-150 Raptor?
It's not my bag. It's just not,
my bag. What if we plug in an F-150 Raptor with a supercharged V8 engine from the Shelby GT500 Mustang making 700 horsepower?
I am not the target market for that truck.
No, hey, I'm kind of with you on that.
I think either, Jason.
This could get a little awkward because I think all three of us are like, I mean, none of us are really that into trucks.
I mean, I am, but I am not into any truck that's been made in the last 20 years.
Nothing wrong with that.
And that's just because I'm that person.
Jump back to a nice square body Chevy or like a 1993 F-150 Knight edition, maybe.
The last pickup I had was an 85 base model F-150 with a rubber floor, a 4-speed, and the inline straight six.
Okay.
Is that the 300?
Man, that's an unstoppable truck right there.
The only options that thing had were the AM/FM cassette and a sliding rear window. And that was the most perfect truck ever built.
I mean, that was back still when trucks were kind of trucks. I had an 89 F-250 diesel super cab long box. And I mean, that was the 8-foot bed with the super cab, with the diesel. For some weird reason, I really kind of missed that truck. But we really should talk about,
you talk about the Raptor. Sorry.
My bad. Really should talk about the new, no. This is why I said it's dangerous, because we're all kind of on like this weird same page. The brand new 2023 Ford F-150 Raptor R has debuted. Technically, we should have covered it last week when we were talking about so many debuts, but we have so many debuts, and this one, we just didn't have a chance to get to this, but how can you not talk about a 700 horsepower F-150 Raptor R? That's what we're looking at here. We pretty much knew it was going to have the Shelby GT500's supercharged V8 engine. And of course, Ford told us way back when the regular Raptor first debuted in this generation, hey, yeah, we're going to have a V8 version. It's going to come soon. That day has finally arrived. And yes, the stats are 700 horsepower, 640 pound-feet of torque. Now, you might be thinking, well, wait a minute. The supercharged 5.2-liter V8 in the Shelby GT500 makes 760 horsepower. Why did they knock this down to 700? And I know some of you, and by some, probably everybody, you're also thinking, well, the Ram TRX makes 702. So technically, that's still the king of the muscle trucks. I imagine that will be the bane of Ford's F-150 Raptor R experience for quite some time, because yes, the new Raptor R, 700 horsepower, it still doesn't make more power than the TRX, but we're talking 2 horsepower, 702 versus 700. It's a moot point. This thing is still going to be fast. And Ford made a big deal to say that it's also quite a bit lighter. It is significantly lighter than the TRX. But I want to talk about that engine really quick. 640 pound-feet of torque. That's actually up from the GT500. And more importantly, for a truck application, that torque is coming in at a lower rev range. 4,250 RPMs is where you reach max torque. So they didn't just put the engine in the truck and cut power for some weird reason. It's actually tuned for truck duty, if you will, giving you a just better, more usable low-end torque at the expense of high-end horsepower. So, and again, we're still talking 700 horsepower.
Smith, can I ask you to put your former marketing hat on for a second for me? I got a question for you.
Okay.
Is there an argument, even if it had resulted in a truck that didn't perform quite as well, is there an argument that Ford should have tuned this thing for, let's call it 704 horsepower? Okay, maybe torque has to drop, so it's making 630 instead of 625 in the GT500, just for the bragging rights? Is there an argument that you don't create maybe as good of a product, but you get that marketing win?
Well, I think the better question there is, I don't even think it would be a question of worse performance. I guess the easy answer is yes. I'm very, very surprised Ford didn't find a way.
Because the difference is so small. It's two horsepower.
Yeah, to just get a little bit more out of it. I mean, realistically, if you run this thing, it could make a little bit more than that, depending on the weather conditions. It could make a little bit less than that. And look, we also know that automakers in general, this isn't just related to Ford or Detroit automaker. Automakers in general love bragging rights. They love to be able to say this vehicle has best in class,
segment leading,
best in class. Insert statistic here, and we have it, right?
Didn't the big three have a truck war? When was it, in the 50s or 60s, about how many lugs their wheels had? Where they were trying to
I don't remember how many lugs
their wheels have.
I don't remember that one, but I mean, that's something that stuck in my head, right?
Right. That's just the lug nut thing was something that stuck in my head that I read a while ago.
Right.
Well, you think about more recently, the torque war when it comes to heavy duty trucks, like
sure.
It's gone from like 800 to 900 to 1,000 foot pounds to over 1,000 foot pounds yeah. that like, right. Or the towing war, like we can tow this much or this much. And in some cases, I forget which one it was, but essentially you would need a CDL in order to actually be able to tow that much. But no one cared because it could tow that much.
Yeah, it's the number. We see that all the time. And that's why this figure was kind of a shock. In real world, you're not going to notice. No. But I guess my question is, if they just dropped the Shelby's engine in there without any adjustments at all, save maybe for some oil cooling, which they did do on the Raptor, just kind of beefed it up for better cooling, bigger oil pan. Would the truck actually perform worse? I mean, is this tuning to get a little bit more torque out of it, really worth the rather substantial horsepower drop. From a marketing standpoint, I mean, my answer is yes. If I was on the marketing team, I would just be just absolutely pulling my hair out. It's like, come on, we had 2 years to beat the Ram TRX and we're going to miss it by 2 horsepower, right? Put a cold air kit on it and get us to 705 or something, right?
Right.
So yeah, that's my answer to the question there. But in real world, it's going to be a moot point. Both of these are going to be just supremely ridiculously quick vehicles. Ford actually hasn't released specific data yet for like 0 to 60 quarter mile times. We know the Ram TRX does 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds, quarter mile in 12.9 at 118. I suspect that the Raptor R is going to be right there, if not even a little bit better, because like we said, it is a fair amount lighter, specifically 5,950 pounds for the Raptor R, which, I mean, it's still heavy, but a TRX checks in at like just under 6,500. So there is a bit of a weight difference there, right?
Yeah, it ends up being a difference of about 400 pounds, which is... That's a chunk of weight.
So yeah, you'll notice that. So yeah, I mean, performance is going to be between these trucks is going to be pretty darn close. But aside from the engine, the Raptor R really isn't any different than the standard Raptor. The only suspension change you'll find on the front, the spring rates are a little bit stiffer to handle the different engine. But underneath the truck, it's still the same. Interior is still the same. You're going to have some small trim updates. On the outside, you have R badging, that power bulge hood on the Raptor R. Little bit bigger than the standard Raptor. One big difference, though, is the price. We do know that.
It's a pretty penny.
And sit down, because the Raptor R starts at $109,415. Now,
in this economy,
in any economy, Jason, $109,415 is the starting price. Now, to just give that a little bit of context, the Raptor R does come standard with just about every option box checked you could get on the regular Raptor. So, I mean, it's riding on the 37-inch tires. It's got all the gear inside. And of course, it has the big engine under the hood. If you were to option up a comparable Ram TRX, that's going to set you back about probably $104,000, $105,000.
So maybe this is my old man moment, but six figures for any truck, Raptor, whatever it is. When you're paying six figures for a pickup truck, my immediate action is, wait, why? What are you thinking?
I mean, the market has shown there's a segment for expensive muscular trucks.
Right. Man, you know how many sweet motorcycles I could get for $109,000? Each any one of them cooler than that truck.
You could get a lot of sweet motorcycles. Do you know how many sweet cars I could get? But again, the market has shown there are people that want these aggressive trucks, and
we don't know
how many Raptor R's Ford will make. You can still get the regular F-150 Raptor, and that's still a really popular seller. But if you just want a high horsepower factory stock muscle truck, the Ram TRX starts under $80,000, and you get 2 more horsepower. Sorry, marketing folks, but people are going to keep coming back to that. But yeah, the Raptor R, we didn't get a chance to talk about it last week. We're talking about it now. I mean, I'm not a truck guy, but it's a cool truck. I'm not going to argue that point at all. It's a cool truck. It's supremely capable with its suspension. It's going to be supremely fast with the engine. $110,000. We'll see. I mean, we'll see how it goes. And if you want to see a little bit more of a comparison, you can go over to MotorOne.com. We do have a really nice comparison. F-150 Raptor R versus Ram TRX, where we line up the horsepower, the engine stats, the weight, the price, all of the stuff, compare it directly. I'm very interested to see what the performance figures are going to be Very interested to see the fuel economy. Ram TRX gets 12 MPG combined. If you're paying $110,000 for a pickup truck, you're probably not worried about fuel mileage, but hey, it'll be interesting to see, right?
Yeah. I don't know. This is just purely on me. It's hard for me to get excited about the muscle trucks. Like, I don't quite get it. Like, I understand why they exist. They clearly sell. If you want to buy one, go for it. It's just not something that gets my heart pumping.
I can get excited about it, but not at 110 grand. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is stuff. I mean, you go back to the original muscle car era. And when I mean by original, I mean, I'm talking like the late 60s, early 70s. The appeal there was these cars were attainable to people. Mm-hmm. I know we live in 2022 and prices on everything are high, but
still
this $100,000 vehicle is not attainable to a good portion of the car buying public. And, you know, it kind of stinks. There are a lot of cool things out there that people can get. And, you know, it's just, it's on another level. It's on another level. So, mm-hmm. Well, probably. I mean, time will tell. We'll see how these sell. We'll see how long, we'll see how long the craze lasts. But we've spent too long on trucks now. We need to jump over to Mr. Jason Marker.
Yes,
because Jason, thank you for your patience as we're going through all of this truck stuff.
Don't worry about it.
You, with your motorcycle knowledge, with your experience, I mean, I'm not even sure where we want to begin. And we already said rideapart.com. You're the editor in chief of Ride Apart. Mm-hmm. You definitely want to go over and check out Ride Apart's content. Even if you don't know a lot about motorcycles or aren't
into motorcycles, we will teach you about motorcycles, and we will make you a person who is into motorcycles, because motorcycles are the raddest thing and they're for everybody.
So Jason, I want you to start. Tell us what you bought in Salem, Oregon. And I want you to explain kind of the most basic level, what it is that makes this bike interesting. And we were kind of talking about this before the show, just like a smattering of history about this motorcycle and why this company is kind of unique.
You don't see very many of these at all. So
you don't. Yes, they only make about, what do they make? Something like 1200 a year, or 1200 or 1800 a year.
And what's the bike that we're looking at now here?
That is a 2022 Ural Gear Up. That's the model I have. That's not the color I have. That's the color I wanted. That's called Garnet Red. It's my favorite color they have this year. But unfortunately I got another color, which is actually a nice color, but just not the one I wanted. Let me start at the beginning. Sure. So Ural started out life back in the 30s as the BMW R71. And when the Nazis took over Germany, BMW had been nationalized, and, you know, the Nazis and the Soviets signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the non-aggression pact. Right.
And you're getting really deep. Like
through that,
just say World War II happened.
Sorry.
No.
It's my thing. Sorry.
You're absolutely right.
The Germans licensed this design to the Soviets to make a bike. And then everything went sideways. You know, the Operation Barbarossa happened. The whole nine yards, the invasion happened.
Many millions of people died.
But this bike, the Soviets wanted this design because they thought it would be good for the Red Army. And it was. And so what happened was they got all the tooling and all the machinery and the plans and everything to make this bike. And they started cranking them out in Moscow, and they called it the M72, I believe. And then here come the Germans, and they split the factories into two parts, and they sent one half of the factory to Irbit, which is in the middle of the country. It's a very pokey little town in the middle of the country. And then they sent the other half of the country to Kyiv in Ukraine. And that's where they cranked out these bikes. And they were strictly military bikes until the 50s. And at that point, the two separate factories were known as IMZ, which was Irbit Motorworks, and KMZ, which was Kiev Motorworks. Eventually, those bikes evolved. IMZ evolved into Ural. KMZ evolved into Dnipro. And at the time, they were still using the original BMW stamping and you know, and tooling and everything. Eventually, that stuff was sold to the Chinese government, and the Chinese government made the Changjiang for the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, or whatever they're called. And they used that same circa 1935 BMW tooling up until the CJs stopped being made, I believe, in the 80s. And actually, I have had my hands on a couple of CJs, like late model CJs, and they are not good because the tooling was so worn out.
Makes sense.
It's been around for a little while.
Never throw anything away. Never throw anything away. But anyway, so what you're looking at here is sort of like the gear up here that you're looking at is the R71's final form. Right.
Would it's fair to so and I'm not to interrupt you, but just want to add, so like I remember when I was writing for Autoblog that they finally introduced fuel injection to
that was in 2014.
That exactly. Like this has been essentially you took a World War II era bike or motorcycle and you just slowly evolved it during the decades and slowly evolved and, you know, did what needed to be done. And you end up with this. You end up with the Ural gear up.
Yep. And now for all throughout the 20th century up until 1989, when the Soviet Union dissolved, Irbit, the IMZ factory in Irbit where Urals were made, it's massive. We talked about this earlier. The number I quoted you is surely wrong, but it's a huge factory because they made everything for the bike in that factory. They made the tires, they made the batteries, they made the cables, they made everything in that factory because that was sort of like Soviet command economy at work, right? And then, everything went to, everything again went sideways in 89 for the Soviets. And there was that decade of chaos, right? That like the 90s was just a disaster. And, everything was stripped bare. If you ever get a chance, read the book Outlaws Incorporated. It's about Wildcat cargo flyers who fly Soviet IL-76 and IL-72, like military cargo planes. A lot of them were just cargo plane crews who left the Soviet Air Force in the 90s with their plane and went into smuggling. It's a great book. It's a phenomenal book.
What's the name again?
Outlaws Incorporated.
Outlaws Incorporated. I might have to check that out.
I want to say it's Outlaws Incorporated on the ground and in the air with the world's most dangerous smugglers or something like that. But it's really good. It's really good. I've read it like 3 or 4 times and I always cry at the end. But anyway, so, the 90s was a very tumultuous and weird time, and they were still cranking out Urals, and they weren't very good. And in the late 90s, they wanted to modernize, and they brought in a consulting firm one of the consultants was a dude named Ilya Kate. And they wanted to modernize. The factory wanted to modernize. And things happen. When this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. And Ilya and his partners in the consulting firm actually bought the factory. And then again, eventually Ilya became the sole owner. And that was in 2000. And he has worked his behind off to make improvements on these bikes every year. And so he and his wife, Madina, Ural is straight up a mom and pop organization, right? I know mom and pop, like I've gone to lunch with them, right? Like they picked me up from the airport one time, right? Like, and so like,
that's cool.
Yeah. It's a very small company. It's their headquarters is in Seattle. It's, Ilya and Medina and their kids live in Seattle. And then like, there's, 20 people, 25 people, maybe 30 at the headquarters. And then 125 people at the factory in Irbit. But we just had some news from from the factory that we'll get into later in the segment about a new facility in Kazakhstan. And that's a whole other thing. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So they've been making slow improvements over the years. You know, they went to 750 cc's. They went to the fuel injection in 2014. In 2019, they revamped the engine again. They revamped the engine a little bit every year, but they went with better pistons, with Teflon skirts and, different architecture in the heads. It's incremental improvements with Urals. And right now, I mean, they're phenomenal motorcycles for what they are, right? They're they're very quirky in a way that I love them so much, right? I love Urals so much. But I wouldn't
would you say it's more kind of about the character?
It is. You don't buy a Ural to buy a motorcycle. You buy a Ural because you want to own a Ural.
Gotcha.
That's right. That makes it very, very clear. And yeah. just to and let everybody know, and just to let everybody know that that's not on YouTube, we're actually looking at a three-wheeled vehicle. This is a motorcycle with a sidecar attached to it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say the other interesting thing, especially with the gear up here, is that it is a two-wheel drive motorcycle, and it that means
it's selectable.
Right, exactly. You can select to engage the drive wheel on the sidecar side. Mm-hmm. So it is essentially a vehicle that if you are in very rough terrain or whatever, like, and you need that extra traction, you can shift in, you can send power to that outside rear wheel, and you have a two-wheel drive motorcycle. It's not powering the front wheel, it's powering the sidecar wheel and the rear wheel.
And the gear up is really, really capable off-road. I mean, it's not a dirt bike, and it's not a GS750, but it's really capable off-road. And you can find videos on YouTube of them, of Ural, testing these things in Siberia, and just fording rivers and bouncing over rocks and everything. They're just, you know, they're tough. They're tough, tough, tough machines. They're very basic. They're very simple machines, but tough and fun. And they have a lot of character.
The sidecar can come off, but it's not designed right?
But you don't want to, you don't buy a Ural to not have a sidecar.
Right.
Like, they made a model called the Solo for a while that didn't come with a sidecar, and it wasn't very popular.
I can imagine.
Yeah, just because you buy a Ural to own a Ural, and part of owning a Ural is having the sidecar, you know. And it's a very basic machine. It's only a 750. It only has a 4-speed transmission, but the 4-speed does have a reverse on it. It's just really basic. You know, no ride modes, no nannies, no ABS. The brakes are by Brembo, so they're very good brakes. You know, but it's very simple, very agricultural. Very tough, you know, and I've been obsessed with them for years, and I've been riding Urals probably since 2017, 2018, when I started reviewing them. And then this one, my OD green one is the first one I've owned myself. And that's actually in 20 some years of riding, it's my very first new motorcycle.
Nice. And you bought this, tell us when you got it, and then tell us about your adventure taking it back to Michigan.
Okay. Great. I think it's time to let's transition into your adventure, purchase. No. History is fascinating, but I think people want to know what you did with it. And I think that's just super cool.
So in March, I believe, I had sold a couple of my fleet of bikes. I sold a couple of old Yamahas that I'd restored, and I had a few grand burning a hole in my pocket, and I've been wanting to buy a Ural for a few years, and my wife had been and I had been talking about it, and I was kicking around, and I found one used on Cycle Trader in Bend, Oregon, at a power sports dealer, not a Ural dealer, and it was a 2019, so it was in my year range because I had the new engine. It was in my price range, and we were going to be in Oregon anyway for some personal stuff. It was my wife and I's 20th anniversary, so we were going to celebrate our anniversary out there.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And the kids have friends out there, and Megan, my wife, had a work conference out there in Portland. So I'm like, oh man, how rad would this be? I'll buy this bike. So I go to my wife's office, and I'm like, baby, I have the dumbest idea I've ever had in my entire life. Would you like to hear it? And she thought for a second. She said, yes, I would like to hear it, because she has put up with a lot of crap from me. And we've been together since 96. So that long, you know, she's put up with a lot of crap from me. So I told her, I'm like, I want to buy this Ural and I want to ride it back cross country. And she's like, that's ridiculous. Let's do it.
That's awesome.
Yes. So, you know, I got everything squared away, and then that deal fell through for some weird, for some weird sort of Oregon law reasons, but it's not worth getting into. It's just very weird. So I got a hold of Ural and I'm like, hey, who's your preferred dealer in Oregon? You know, I still want to buy a bike. Who should I buy it from? So they pointed me at Raceway Ural in Salem, which was actually closer and more accessible a place than Bend for where we were going to be. So I called up there, and the bike you're looking at is the bike I bought. And Robbie, who's the guy that owns Raceway, he's like, yes, I have this bike available. That's all I got. And I'll cut you a good deal on it. And he did. And I bought it. And then I had to wait like a month and a half before we flew to Portland, and it was killing me. So I spent that whole time, you know, buying supplies for the trip, setting up tests, you know. So I had a lot of gear to review, rain gear and a helmet and a comm system for my helmet and luggage and stuff like that, even my earplugs. So I, you know, the day came, we flew out, I went and I picked it up on June 20th. And like I said, from June earlier, like from June 20th to July 6th, I lived out of that motorcycle. The first week, though, my wife and I toured around Oregon and celebrated our anniversary, right? We love road trips, but it had been a long time since we've been on a road trip. We have two little girls. They're 12 and 9. They take a lot of work, right? So we don't really travel like long distance road trips as much as we used to. So it was really cool. You know, she bundled into the sidecar and she rides too. She hasn't ridden in a while, but she has a cycle endorsement and is a rider herself. Cool. And, you know,
So you toured around like a week before your trip on the bike.
On the bike. So we did a little over 500 miles in 3 days, I think. We went out to the Oregon coast. We camped. We went north up the coast. We stayed in this really cool hotel in a town called Depot Bay, which is the whale watching capital of America. Saw some whales. It was very cool. And then we returned to Portland. Then I left on Friday the 24th, and I drove north, rode north from Portland to Seattle, where I saw some friends, some old bandmates of mine. And then I had a rest. I spent 2 days there, and then I headed east on the 26th.
From Oregon all the way eventually to, or from Washington eventually all the way. Yeah,
that's Mount St. Helens there, by the way.
Yeah, we're looking at what we're looking at now. And again, Motor One Podcast on YouTube. You can go see what we're talking about here. There's the Ural with Mount St. Helens in the background. Fortunately, did not erupt this time.
No, it was very cool. We'll get to the picture of after I had done. There it is. Go there. See it? Click that.
Is that one you want?
No, the one below that.
Gotcha.
That's me testing the four-wheel drive in the snow.
Oh, nice.
Or the two-wheel drive.
Riding the bike through the snow.
Dude, I got up. I ended up by accident because I just put Portland to Seattle, no highways in my nav. And I ended up in the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument and basically rode up and down the mountain beside Mount St. Helens. And I got to the top of the mountain and there were snowdrifts taller than me. It was really cool. Along the way, you know, that first part, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, I was able to stop at a place called Hinterlands Coffee, or Hinterlands Empire. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's a art space, like a shop, a DIY place, a coffee roastery, and a motorcycle hangout and an LGBTQ safe activity space. Right. It's very cool. Run by this really rad person named Trina. And I went in there and I'm like, man, all I need is like a cup of coffee and a bag of coffee for the road. I'm only going to be here 15 minutes. I'm going to say hi to Trina, because she and I had been talking on Instagram, and then I was going to leave. I was there for like 3.5 hours, right?
As they do.
Because you saw all the choppers and everything at the beginning and the old Japanese bikes. All these young people on these old bikes and these choppers they built themselves. And when I say young people, I mean people in their 20s. They were there and they were going to a rally and they were staging at Hinterlands. And so I bought some stickers for the bike. I bought some coffee. You know, I hung out and talked to Trina about stuff and talked about bikes and this and that. I even did some of my ride apart work. And then I left and then I went to, you know, Seattle and then East. These pictures you're going through right now they're basically from the middle of Washington State where the mountains end and the plateau begins. I don't know what to call that. This was a gorgeous valley I entered at sunset. And it was so lonely. It was right by the Grand Coulee Dam. It was so lonesome and gorgeous and beautiful. And I love high desert. I love mountains and canyons and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just had to pull over and stand there. And it was just silent. It was one of the most silent places I've ever been. And just the sun was going down over the mountains. And just this amazing experience. You know, it was just my kind of thing. And that's probably the best picture I took the entire trip. Or at least it's my favorite.
I mean, it's a good shot. And I've been on some trips like that out here in South Dakota in the Mustang. And I think I know what you're talking about. There are certain places where it's just like one of my favorite is actually as you're crossing from South Dakota into Montana. There's actually a little I think it's Highway 212, which is on
Highway 212. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's just like a flat, empty stretch of road. Kind of going through just the high prairie right there. You're north of the Black Hills. So you're out of the hills and it's just kind of a very desolate stretch, but right there where you cross into Montana, there's a little spot obviously where people pull over. And I think the second time I was out that way, I was in the Mustang and it's like, you know what? I need to stop here.
Yeah.
And just pulled over and you just look around and you can just see everything around you. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of still and surreal. I can only imagine the experience of riding this bike across country.
It was really amazing. You know, it was, so, you know, from Washington, I went through the top of Idaho down into Montana. I had two stops in Montana. Then I went into Wyoming, to Thermopolis, Wyoming, to the world's largest natural hot spring and took in the waters. I really like Thermopolis. It's a neat little town. Had a great breakfast there and was able to take in the waters at the hot springs, which was very cool. From Thermopolis, I think I came to your place from Thermopolis.
Yeah, your plans changed a little bit.
My plans changed in the middle because I realized – I could only do about between 350 and 400 miles a day on this bike.
Yeah. So what's the top speed of it?
65, 60.
So,
let's roll that back a little bit. Every speed limit is aspirational on the Ural. Okay.
But so, yeah, I mean, you're limited in the distance that you can cover.
Right. And I was on all 2-lane blacktop. I wasn't doing any freeway.
Yep.
Although I did actually do some freeway, I did some, I-90, from the Badlands to Sioux Falls.
Yeah, that stretch of I-90 doesn't really count as highway because you pass like five cars in the span of 300 miles.
Right. And I just kept it at 60 miles an hour in the right lane and hunkered down and it was good.
I was really stoked that you were able to stop by my place in Rapid City. We got a chance to hang out.
Yeah, that was very cool.
We got a chance to fix the Ural.
You did
have to fix it later on.
I did have to fix it again. The one problem I had was a high pressure fuel line on the right injector. And it delaminated inside. And I think it has to do with the corn juice that you guys call gas out there. Because it's a Teflon coated fuel line, and the Teflon lining basically delaminated from the inside of the hose and slid down the hose and bunched up around the bottom of the hose where it goes into the injector.
Okay. So that's what was going on. We just thought it was kind of a loose clamp. Cause you get to my house, right. And I've got the garage open. It's like, bring the bike in, pulls in. Hey, how you doing?
Fuel everywhere.
it's like, why is it smoky?
Fuel leak.
So yeah, I mean, just found that little hose, but yeah,
That's the Teflon liner.
Wow.
You know, and it was just, I would cut a piece off of it and I would put it back on and it'd be fine. Then it would slide down a little more and I'd have to do it again. And eventually I ran out of slack on the fuel line and I had to go to O'Reilly's and buy some fuel line, you know?
We do have a little bit of ethanol out here. I've found one station where I can get premium without ethanol.
The bike calls for premium because it doesn't have any ethanol in it. But a couple of the gas stations I went into, and I forget who they were, but it was always the same like line of stores. They only had 89 octane. Whoa. They didn't have any like 93 or 91, and it was all like 15% corn. And I'm pretty sure that's what happened there.
So Jason, I've got a question for you. You've got this picture of all of your gear laid out. And
that's an insane amount of gear, by the way, to have with you on a motorcycle. And that's awesome.
I was on the road for a long time.
It looks like there are multiple first aid kits, maybe. Nope, anyway,
just one.
Okay. No, but to tell our listeners how you prepared for this trip, what you brought with you to be ready, willing, and able.
The sidecar was full.
So there's a woman named Amanda Zito, and she runs a YouTube channel as the Magpie Flies, and she is a professional wanderer. She's a professional nomad. She lives off of her Honda adventure bike and makes YouTube videos. And she does a lot of backcountry camping. She's sponsored by a bunch of, you know, bike gear companies and everything. And that's all she does. She rides around the country and camps and makes these videos. And she's really cool. She's really, really cool. And I used a bunch of her videos on how to pack for long distance travel and camping and adapted them to my uses, you know, because I wasn't going to be backcountry camping. I only camped a couple of days and it was pretty civilized everywhere I was. So I had primarily three bags. I had my my clothes bag, which was a Givi. I want to say that's a 40-liter roll top duffel bag. That one right there, waterproof. I had all my clothes and my dop kit in there, and my stuff bag for my dirty clothes. So that was in there, and that went on the floor of the sidecar between the seat and the nose. Also in the sidecar, I had 2 gallons of water that I was using for my water bottles that I was using to wash and brush my teeth and the whole thing. On the seat, I had my cooler. I had my vacuum bottle for coffee, my vacuum bottle for ice water. I also had my first aid kit, a roll of paper towels, a packet of wipes, my road atlas.
And a road atlas. There's something that you don't see anymore in the age of GPS.
And I got to use it a couple of times.
Nice.
It eventually got destroyed in a rainstorm in Wisconsin. It got destroyed in a rainstorm in Wisconsin, so that was that. And then I had a tank bag. If you zoom out a little bit, the tank bag is right in front of the front wheel. That guy right there. So that had my tablet, my keyboard, my microphones, my gimbal for my phone, pens and pencils, all my cables, my headlamp, my battery, which was made by zero gravity batteries. That thing right there that says XP1 on it, that can jump a car. That can jump a car with a V6 in it. So I had it so that I could jump the Euro if I had to. Plus, it's got USB outs on it. It has outs for laptops. I had that inverter. I had that in the sidecar, using the PowerPoint in the sidecar. I had a bottle of bear spray just in case, you never know. And I had my paper notebook, and all of that stuff was stuffed in the tank bag, and the tank bag attaches to the tank with magnets, so it sticks there.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. And that was a great bag. That was also a Givi bag. And then if you scroll a little bit to the left, this Givi here on the left, this kind of rectangular one, the 65 liter guy, that had all my camping equipment in it. So, you know, my tent, I have a friend that does bicycle camping. She does long distance bicycle touring and bicycle camping. So she loaned me her tent, which is a big Agnes two-person backpacking tent. Like, if you go up a little bit, scroll the picture up a little bit. See this? These two. Oops. No, right. See these two gray. These two gray tubes right here, in front of the bag.
Tubes.
Yep. Yep. I got them.
Bag.
Right there.
I don't see them. Oh. Yeah.
Okay. That's my tent.
Okay.
And then the thing that says Nemo was my ground, my sleeping pad.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, you were
everything just scrunched down. Everything just scrunched down. And then, so then I had my freeze dried food from Peak Refuel. I had my
wait. Freeze dried. You had freeze dried food with you?
Yeah, for camping. And then I kept my snacks in my cooler. My regular road snack is like hunter sausages or hard salamis, baby tomatoes, baby bell cheeses, and baguettes.
I'm just waiting for you to be like, yeah, this is the slingshot that I packed with me to take out rabbits. You know, if I needed to take out rabbits.
The only weapon I brought was the bear spray. And then, so yeah, so all my camping equipment and then like paracord, bug spray, sunscreen, some extra equipment and everything. That was all in the camping bag. And it was strapped to the luggage rack on top of the spare wheel. Now, under the spare wheel is a trunk. It's like a three cubic foot trunk. And really? In the trunk was my rain gear that was provided to me by Speedy. It's this sort of gray and red and black jacket and these black rain pants. That saved my bacon a couple of times. And then my tool roll, my mini compressor, and all my tire repair equipment and my emergency equipment was all in there.
Huh.
So I had about 150 pounds of gear. So I had the equivalent of a passenger on the bike.
Sure.
And the bike handles better the heavier the sidecar is loaded.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you because you were talking to me a little bit about this when you stopped by out here. What are some of the riding and handling characteristics of this bike? Because it's not what you would expect.
It's not. It's completely different than riding a regular motorcycle. You do more direct steering than counter steering. So you're always sawing at the handlebars, right?
Hmm.
And you're using your, like, this bike needs wider handlebars for more leverage, especially when the sidecar is all loaded up, especially when it was me, my wife, and all of our gear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The sidecar, the most important thing is the sidecar has its own momentum. And it swings off the right side of that bike like a pendulum. Now, it's got a brake on it. You know, it's got a very good Brembo two-pot brake on it, disc brake. But
Wait. A separate brake? Or
it does. Yeah. It's still linked to the rear brake pedal. So the rear brake on the bike and the brake on the sidecar are activated at the same time. But they have separate master cylinders and separate systems. They're just linked at the brake pedal. Physically linked.
Yeah.
And then the front brake is controlled by the right hand lever.
Yeah.
The sidecar has its own momentum and its own weight, right? And it's not driven unless you have the driven wheel on, but just in day-to-day use, it's not driven. So you have to compensate for that constantly. And for example, when you take off from a stop, the sidecar's a fraction of a second behind the bike because the sidecar hasn't come up to speed yet.
Huh.
So the bike wants to yaw to the right when that happens. And then under heavy braking or even regular braking, and you have to compensate for this, the sidecar is still moving and it's moving at a little bit faster speed than the bike is. And it wants to swing around to the right. So the bike yaws to the left. I'm sorry, it wants to swing around to the left, so the bike yaws to the left under heavy braking. And that's more pronounced when it's more pronounced when the sidecar is lighter.
Just for the record, I love this sort of thing. I mean, this is what gives what might otherwise just be plain old machinery, like, personality.
Mm-hmm. This bike's got a lot of personality.
And distinctiveness. You don't just get on it and go.
Right.
It has quirks. It has ways in which it acts and responds. And it's like, you don't just get on it and go. I mean, you have to get to know it. You have to develop a relationship with it.
Mm-hmm. And I did over. So my total was 3,800 miles on this trip.
Wow.
You know, wow. And you know, after South Dakota, I went up into Minnesota and I stayed the weekend right before the July 4th. I spent the first weekend of July with my old buddy, Sam. And Sam was actually my editor in a former life when I did, when I wrote pen and paper role-playing games. He was my editor for Star Wars and for Warhammer 40K and Wait. For Legend of the Five Rings.
That's another podcast we got to do right there.
Yeah, that's another show.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that, but Sam was my editor there.
We could lose hours there.
So yep, So I stayed with him for a couple of days and then headed from there to Madison, Wisconsin to see another old gaming colleague of mine. And then my last night, I was supposed to camp at Warren Dunes State Park in Michigan.
Okay.
And before that, I had a stop laid out in a town called Hammond, Indiana. And Hammond, Indiana is right at the southern point of Lake Michigan. And it is a smaller, shabbier, more rundown version of Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
And that is not a joke.
That's Hammond rough.
I love that you and I were like, this
Hammond is kind of a mess. But
we know, well, no, it's we know Gary. Gary, Indiana. Gary is not a
It's great right next town. To Gary. It's right next to Gary. So Hammond, I rode through it in 2018 because I was returning a Harley Davidson to Milwaukee that Harley had loaned me for the summer to review. And I was riding Michigan 12 the whole way to Chicago. And I drove past this taco joint and it was in an old mid-century hamburger joint with a glass front and the angled roof.
Oh,
right.
Cool.
And yeah. I couldn't stop because I was running so late and I'm like, cause I love a traditional taco place. And I'm like, all the signs on that place are in Spanish and it sells birria tacos. It sells goat tacos. And I'm like, I can't stop now, but I'll drop a pin on it. For 4 years, I was craving those tacos and staring at that pin on Google. And I finally, that was like the one definite stop I had to make on this trip. So I finally stopped at Liberia Superior, whatever it was. And it was blazing hot, miserably hot outside. They didn't have any inside seating. I got my tacos, you know, Abue who ran the place. She didn't have any English, you know, the tacos were as phenomenal as I thought they were going to be.
Nice.
But it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I was done with dinner or lunch. And I was only a half an hour away from Warren Dunes, but I was 4 hours away from home.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh man, I know I'm tired and I know it's late. I'm 4 hours away from home, what Nav says, but it's probably six and a half hours. Let's just jump on M12 and see how far I can get. And I did. I got almost all the way home. I got into an area of Michigan called the Irish Hills, which is
familiar.
It's really beautiful there. Michigan 12 runs through it. It's very hilly. Some really nice riding roads. I actually call it my proving grounds because when I have a bike to review or I have a bike that I've recently restored and recommissioned, put back on the road, I take them out there and I flog them around the roads in the Irish Hills just to really, you know, run the money's worth out of them.
It's a very unique part of the state because
it is.
The topography isn't like anything else in the area. And that's also where you'll find Michigan International Speedway.
Mm-hmm.
For the racers out there.
Yep. It's
part of the state.
It's a natural lake district. You know, it's called the Irish Hills because it was, you know, basically settled by a bunch of the Irish diaspora. Mm-hmm. But my wife's family has a little lake house out there on one of the smaller lakes. And that was as far as I could go that night. You know, so I called my mother-in-law and I'm like, hey, can I just crash at the cabin tonight? And they're like, oh yeah, go ahead. You know, keys, you know where the key is.
Don't tell us where the key is.
No, I'm not going to tell you where the key is, but it was like, you know, so I got to crash in the cabin that night and, you know, finish my last night evening on the road, you know, in style. And then the next morning I had a hour and a half ride back to Detroit and, you know, got home right after lunch and it was nice. It was nice to be home. You know, I missed my wife. I missed my kids. I missed my dog.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, 2 weeks on the road and I gotta be honest, when I travel, when I do trips, and maybe it's just because I always have someplace I absolutely have to be in a certain time. I mean, I'm the type of, okay, let's get going. I don't necessarily blatantly destroy the speed limit, but I'm either at the speed limit or going a little bit over. Going along 60, 65 miles an hour sounds simultaneously extraordinarily enjoyable and relaxing and frustrating at the same time. I mean,
No, I was never frustrated. I mean, awesome. All I had to do was get home. Really, I wish I had had another week, because there were places that I wanted to stop, things I wanted to see, because when I travel like this, man, all I want to do is I want to read every historical marker I come across. I want to go to every roadside attraction I find. You know, I had to drive by the Corn Palace. I had to drive right by it to get to Sioux Falls.
You know, I live out here and I've never even stopped at the Corn Palace. You know how many times I've gone past it? Because, you know, when I'm on the trip, it's like, okay, I'm usually going from here and to Michigan, and my stop point is usually Marinette, Wisconsin, which is right on the border with Michigan. That's like about a 900-mile trip. So it's like, you know what? I'm on the road at 5:36 in the morning, 80 miles an hour or so, which is the speed limit in South Dakota.
Right.
And I've been out here for 7 years. I've never stopped at the Corn Palace. One of these days, maybe.
But like, you know, I started my days around 7 o'clock. I would get up, get moving. I would have breakfast. I would go someplace and find breakfast. Man, I ate so many good breakfasts on this trip. And
that's awesome, because I enjoy breakfast too. Right?
It's the most important meal of the day, and it's my favorite meal of the day. And then I would stop and I would make a video for the day to publish on Ride Apart. You know, hey guys, you know, I'm here, I'm doing this, you know, stay tuned. And then along the way, I would stop and shoot pictures for our social media channels. And you could tell as I went on, like, it takes so long to stop, get off the bike, take my helmet off, block these shots, make sure the light's right, shoot these shots, wait for people to get the hell out of my way so I can shoot these shots, right? It's just like, I'm losing 5 minutes here and 10 minutes there. And that turns a 6 hour ride into a 12 hour ride.
Right.
You know,
and how many times did you have people come up to you asking you about the bike? Like when you pull over,
many. Just
getting shots or fueling up or eating?
Many. A lot of conversations started with, never heard of a U-Rail before.
A U-Rail.
And I got my spiel down real well after the first couple of days. I met dozens of cool people and two jerks on the trip. So a pretty good mix, you know?
Yeah.
And just, you know, it was really cool to just be in nature and be one with, this sounds hokey, but it, like, be one with the machine, right? Like the Ural and I developed a really good working relationship on the trip.
Dude, that's not hokey at all. In fact, I would say that's in the heart of Bruce and I. I mean, that's what rambling about cars is all about.
Right on.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's, and then, you know, when I got home, it was like 3,800 miles in the saddle. And, you know, over that time, I'm like, well, I need to change this about the bike, and I need to change that about the bike, and this is perfect, and this is iffy, and this and that. And then, man, I spiraled. I just went into a real dark place when I got home, because I was coming. I just came down off of the rush, you know. And this past weekend, I was joking with some friends of mine. I microdosed my trip because I went to Vintage Motorcycle Days out in Mid-Ohio Raceway.
Oh, you did?
Cool. Yeah. And I did 600 miles on the bike this past weekend.
Nice.
I had to combine it with some family stuff, but found some really great roads in Southeast Ohio where my dad's from. And then went to Vintage Motorcycle Days and got all muddy out in the infield or out in the camping field. But yeah, it's just, it was a lot. It was very intense, like emotionally, to be on the bike for so long. And like, you know, I had all this great gear and all this great equipment that I was loaned, you know, for reviews. And like two of the pieces of equipment I had really failed me. And
what failed, I guess.
You will read in my reviews.
That's what I was about to ask. Cause we're getting towards the end of the podcast.
Sure.
Jason, do you have a write-up for this yet over at Ride Apart?
Not yet, man. It's been pretty chaotic. So what I'm doing is I'm doing three shorter pieces on the ride. So I'm doing Pacific Northwest, I'm doing Mountain West and Great Plains, and I'm doing Midwest and Home.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, and basically it's going to be what we just talked about here with all these photos in it, you know? And I'm going to talk about more, like I'm going to talk about the ghost town I found, and I'm going to talk about the cattle drive that I saw, and I'm going to talk about, you know, changing my itinerary in the middle. And I'm going to talk more about, you know, more things that I saw, you know, in depth when I can do that in 1,000 words, you know? And then I have a ton of reviews to write. You know, I have reviews for all my luggage to write. I have reviews for my helmet and my helmet cam. I have reviews for my jacket and, you know, my rain jacket and my rain pants and my boots. Yeah, my boots and my green leather jacket that I was wearing and my gloves and like all this stuff that I need to review. So I'm going to be busy for the next couple of months writing these reviews.
Well, cool. I mean,
that sounds great.
You had what I would consider a life-changing experience.
It was pretty intense. It wasn't my first cross-country road trip, but
something with that kind of character. Yeah, I mean, something that special, a bike like that with that kind of character, spending 11 days, not including the time you spent previous, just kind of getting to know the bike with your wife. Yeah, that's. I mean,
and being alone, you know, I like to be alone. I'm kind of a real talkative introvert, you know, or introvert extrovert, you know, where I love to go out and meet people and just socialize and you know, talk to people and meet people, but then I need to go home. You know, like, well, I need to go home and have quiet and recharge my batteries.
Well, let me just take this moment to share with you and all of the ramblers listening. Thanks for stopping by on your visit, taking some time
out.
Thanks
for having me.
It was a pleasure to finally get to meet you in person, and you'd made me feel so happy and confident that I wasn't going crazy. Oh. When we were in the garage trying to get that fuel line figured out, and you were like, I think I said, no, you know what? I've got a little small clamp. Let me get back here into my little stash to get a little clamp to put on that hose. And I moved to the back of the garage. And while I'm there, I hear you like talking to yourself and or the bike.
Yes.
You're just having a regular conversation. Yeah. And it's like, okay, I'm not the only one that does that, right?
Well,
How many times did I talk to the Mustang when I did my road trip to Michigan? Because I mean, that was all a solo trip. It's like, how many times am I talking to the car? How many, like when I was coming back and I get up to the Badlands and the temperature gauge is climbing because it's 100 degrees outside and it's an older car and I've got to put down the windows and run the heat to make sure the engine stays cool. And then it's like, there is a storm up here that could be dropping some big hail, Mustang. We need to get our shit together and get past this storm. And then it's like the temperature gauge drops.
Yep.
The car is like, all right, let's do this. Let's having this conversation. Let me ask, did you have any moments like that on your trip with the bike?
This bike and I had so many good conversations on the road. And because I talk like that because I have a very loud, very constant inner monologue. Right. Uh-huh. And so my brain's always working internally and then it comes out when I talk. I think I told you this. I don't know if I've ever told you this, Bruce, but I have whenever I'm working on a bike, I have imaginary engineers that I cuss when I run into something I find ridiculous. Right. Like, why is this part?
That's what you were doing when you know, were here.
And so like, I primarily work on Japanese bikes, primarily Yamahas and Hondas. And so I'm always cussing Hero. Damn it, Hero. Why is that there? unless I'm working on Hondas where I cuss the old man himself, you know, where I cuss Soichiro. Damn it, Soichiro.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm working on German bikes, it's Kurt or maybe Klaus. Klaus. You know, I've never worked on an Italian bike, but if I did, it would be Mario. You know,
so when you work on the Ural, is it going to be Ivan?
It's Yuri.
Yuri, of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's Daryl when I'm working on American bikes.
Daryl.
Damn it, Daryl. You know, but yeah, so the bike, I got my custom plate for it. It's Yuri G. Yuri Gagarin was the first person in space.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm not a person that believes in heroes. I don't believe in hero worship and the great man and everything. Yuri Gagarin is the closest I have to a personal hero. You know,
for sure.
He was charismatic. He was brave. He was handsome. He had a great smile. He was a cool dude. He was the first human being in space. right?
And that's, I mean, that's, you want me to do what?
Yeah.
You know,
and like he threw a drink in Khrushchev's face one time and got away with it.
Yeah.
You know, that's how cool that's how big a hero he was in the Soviet Union. Mm. And so, you know, this is Ural Gagarin and I have my Yuri G plate. And it's also a playful reference to a PJ Harvey song called Yuri G.
I don't know that one.
Okay. But yeah, you know, you asked me way back at the beginning, you know, why I bought a Ural. It's because we're a one car family and now we're a one car and one Ural family because I take, you know, I take my kids to school in this thing. You know, I go.
Do you really? Going to ask about that. Like,
oh, yeah, my kids love it
to ride this.
Oh yeah, Katerina, my oldest, she was in band camp when I got home, and her little sister Natalia had a straight up brawl in the backyard, fighting over who was going to get to ride in the sidecar first. And, you know, I took Kat to band camp one morning, and she's telling me as we pull in, she's like, "Okay, now we have to pull up here so everybody can see me."
and how she's cool like, is that? Usually like the kids are like, "Yeah, right? Up a block away because I don't want anybody to see me with my dad."
And then she's like, "And when you come back, make sure you park in front of that door because we come out of that door when band camp is over." And I was parked right there, and the doors flipped open, and all these kids poured out, and there's Dad on the Ural with his feet up on the nose of the sidecar. You know, I'm looking at my phone, you know, my leathers and my helmets hanging on the mirror.
Did you throw
in
a few blips?
Yeah. No, it was not. It wasn't running. You can't leave it running.
Oh, okay.
It'll overheat.
And it's pretty quiet too.
It is. It's very quiet. But yeah, it was just, she loved that. She was so smug when she hopped in the sidecar and like get calling her friends, "Come look at my dad's cool bike." And then was like super smug when she hopped in and we tootled away. So they really like it. My wife wants me to teach her how to pilot it.
Okay.
Because, you know, she used to ride and she still has her cycle endorsement, but she's never ridden a sidecar. So she's like, "You got to teach me how to pilot it because I want to ride it." So, yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, we're, you know, that's my wife right there.
Okay.
You know, she was excited about the trip. We had a great time on the road together.
Nice.
That's my girls, man. Right there.
That's, what a great story. What a cool bike. What a cool adventure. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on the show and listening to us talk about trucks for the first half there.
Sure.
Folks, what do you think about all of this? You know the drill by now. Send us email podcast@motorone.com. You can always, always, always comment on our YouTube videos that go up. Motor One Podcast is the YouTube channel. For those listening, audio only on Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever you're listening, we are always happy to have you listening. If you have a chance to catch us on YouTube, fine. If not, stick right there on your audio platform. Share the news about rambling about cars. We are growing slowly. We want to continue growing. Jason, you are going to have a three-part story on your Ural adventure.
And hopefully part one is going to be up within the next week.
Within the next week or so. Rideapart.com, folks. Rideapart, all one word, rideapart.com, where you can go and catch this story. Now, Rideapart also does all kinds of reviews, news on motorcycles,
lifestyle, history, gear reviews,
yep,
cool stuff, drag races. Yeah.
Great gear reviews. I love looking at I own a 110cc Honda, so it's not exactly, I'm not going cross country, but you guys do great gear reviews.
Thanks,
Jason. Anything else you want to shout out, man? Socials, any other projects?
Not really. Just, you know, everybody come and check out Ride Apart. You know, check out our social channels. We're not the best at social media, but we try.
You're pretty good. Don't sell yourself short.
Not as good as you guys are. I mean, I forget to do the Instagram posts because, you know, it's just me. And, you know, keep an eye on us, you know, keep an eye out for us doing things. If ever I'm riding around or any of our riders are riding around, we'll always put it on social media. So, you know, you might see us, you might see me out on the Ural, you might see my senior rider, Janicki, you might see her out on an electric bike this year because we're doing electric summer. Sweet. We're right in the middle of our electric summer. Or you might see our senior youths correspondent, Dustin, who lives down in LA. You might see him riding bikes out there in LA and doing our reviews. And yeah, if you happen to be in the Philippines, you might see the Manila desk out there having a good time. So, you know,
sweet.
We'll always put on social media when we're out on an adventure.
The destination, if you're into two or
three-wheeled
vehicles, outstanding. Right? Jason, man, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No, we loved having you on. And for all the Motor One folks out there, I have to apologize. Things have gotten kind of busy with me recently for reasons I'm not going to get into, but I did not respond to any of the comments to last week's podcast. I apologize for that. I will be getting to that.
That's on me too. In fact, I was actually checking the comments before we recorded tonight's episode. I'm actually going to be jumping in there to do some responses, and we'll get to those comments next week as well, because I mean, we had some really great comments from last week's episode.
Yep, I saw them. I just apologize. I did not react to them like I usually do. I apologize for that. But anyway, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. We super appreciate Jason being on. I would love to have him back on some like super slow news week so that Smith and Jason and I could just nerd out about anime and Star Wars and
You know what? I can tie Star Wars into cars, because my specialty for Star Wars, you know, was ships, vehicles, and guns and gear. And I used to do things like, I did a whole line of vehicles in one book where all of their number designations were Chrysler engine displacements.
Well, we're going to have to discuss that.
I had the 318 and I had the 440, you know, the whole thing. You know,
so. Nice.
Well, yeah. So Jason is definitely going to be back, and we are going to be super nerdy, and it's going to be some like episode in January or February where you folks don't care, and it's going to be super fun for us.
It'll be epic.
Yep. All right. But other than that, so yeah, goodbye to everyone. Jason, thanks for joining us. Smith, as always, thanks. And bye-bye, everybody.
We'll see you next time.
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks a lot.